The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Also want to remind you the North Carolina Reading Service cordially invites you to attend our biggest fundraiser of the year, the New Visions Gala, celebrating a brighter future. Now, this very special event will take place on Friday, September 9th, coming closer, and it'll be from 6:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at the Raleigh Hilton North Hills. And you can join us for a fun-filled evening that will feature New Vision Showcase that highlights the latest technology for the vision of visually impaired. Also, a cocktail hour, dinner, silent auctions, music by Barbara and Hinton, and much more. The tickets are $125 per person, and you can RSVP by August 31st, please. And for more information and to buy the tickets, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138, and we look forward to seeing you there. Now, today on Armchair Traveler, we continue with part four of our five-part series, We Are Here. This is the cover story from the July 2022 issue of National Geographic. Writer Charles C. Mann, along with photographer Kiliai Yuan, tell the story of how North America's indigenous nations are reclaiming their sovereignty. And this includes control of their land, their laws, and how they live. Today in Chapter 4, we learn about the Haudenosaunee of New York. And the title of this particular chapter is Restoring the Corn. So let us begin. When we walked into the barn, Angela Ferguson was sitting in a camp chair, glasses propped on her head, ankle deep in ears of dried corn. Around her, the husking bee was in full swing. A dozen people in western New York shucking and braiding, plastic crates beside them full of husk and cobs. The cobs were glossy and multicolored, a panoply of red and yellow and cream and slate blue-gray. Inside the barn were three main rooms. Like a cheerful, exuberant general, Ferguson directed operations in the middle room. Behind her and the other huskers was a second room full of wheeled metal racks. Corn ears braided together by their dried husk hung from the racks, several dozen varieties, none of them remotely similar to supermarket corn. More braids, equally varied, dangling from the ceiling. All of this would be ground into flour for traditional dishes or preserved as seed for indigenous farmers. The third room remains closed with the attendant outside 24/7. Ferguson led us inside with a flourish. It's a library. But instead of books, the room is lined floor to ceiling with neatly labeled glass jars. Inside each jar are corn kernels, more than 4,000 varieties altogether. I cried when I saw these for the first time, she said. It was more than I could have imagined was possible. Ferguson is Onondaga. Onondaga are one of the six nations of the Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois Confederacy, whose homelands is what is now upstate New York and southern Ontario. In tales by early U.S. writers such as James Fenimore Cooper and Washington Irving, the Haudenosaunee are portrayed as fierce warriors, and it is indeed true that for three centuries the Six Nations have furiously resisted their colonizers. But that misses a much more important part of their identity. The Haudenosaunee thought of themselves as highly skilled farmers, people who transformed their northerly landscape into an agricultural powerhouse. The foundation of that powerhouse was corn. The world's most important staple crop, corn was developed almost 10,000 years ago in southern Mexico. By about A.D. 1000, it had spread throughout the Turtle Island. Everywhere it went, local breeders adapted it, creating thousands of types, from 2-inch cobs with tiny deep red kernels for popcorn to cobs almost 2 feet long with thumbnail-sized kernels that Ferguson said dance atop boiling soup. This festival of diversity is preserved in the Onondaga Library. The U.S. takeover of indigenous societies is often described in terms of land, but it was also an assault on culture, banning religions, suppressing languages, even prohibiting games like Ishtaboli. or stickball. A little noticed aspect of the conquest was that it became even harder, or ever harder, for indigenous peoples to grow and eat their own foods, as central to their identities as it is to other cultures around the globe. Ferguson told me she is just a traditional corn grower who always had a little family garden. 12 years ago, she decided to work on a larger scale, growing corn for elders. It was selfish, she said, laughing. I just gave them some corn, and they gave me so much knowledge in return, recipes at first, and then the history of our people. In 2015, she persuaded the Onondaga Nation to help her expand. She and her collaborators staged community gatherings with free food, traditional Haudenosaunee varieties of corn, of course, but also beans, squashes, fruits, vegetables, fish, and venison. The food draws people together, Ferguson said. It's medicine, medicine in our sense, not the drugstore sense. I would get up from the table and feel the power of our community. The next year, Ferguson co-founded Braiding the Sacred with the goal of bringing back indigenous farms and foods across Turtle Island. Braiding the Sacred is part of a movement called Food Sovereignty. From this perspective, food is a bond that unites people, health, and land. One of the organization's first tasks was to visit the home of Carl Barnes. Born in 1928 in the Oklahoma Panhandle, Barnes was fascinated as a child by the tales of his Cherokee grandfather. Like the Haudenosaunee, the Cherokee had a rich agricultural tradition, but one that had faded. Barnes worked his family farm and used his spare time to collect the seeds of ancient varieties from across North America. By the 1990s, he had thousands of types of corn, beans, squashes, and other crops. Barnes, who died in 2016, willed his collection to friends who contacted Braiding the Sacred. A year later, the collection began arriving on Onondaga land. Ferguson had the melancholy realization that some of these seeds no longer have their people. The people who grew them were wiped out or absorbed into other tribes. The seeds are here, but they're like ghosts. Now Braiding the Sacred is working with more than 100 farmers in a dozen or so nations. The younger generation is the key, Ferguson and others told me. I just seen students at the Asquashani Freedom School harvesting in the fields. Founded in 1979, the Mohawk Immersion School in northern New York is a center of cultural resurgence. The Mohawk are another of the Haudenosaunee Six Nations. Taken to a Mohawk community farm on a cold October day, the teenagers had fanned out into the field, snapping off ears from the plants. Unlike today's hybrid corn, traditional varieties grow to different heights. The students were harvesting Mohawk short nose maize, usually from 3 to 5 feet tall. Typical agricultural machinery can't harvest it. The kids, talking across the corn rows in English and Mohawk, tossed the ears into a cart pulled by a trailer. Watching them like a profound grandfather was Tom Kenakatiat Cook, a Mohawk writer and longtime activist. He'd been one of the original stringers for the Asquashani News, the first indigenous newspaper, in the 1960s. I asked him if we were looking at a vision of the future. I see what you're getting at, he said, but this isn't the future. This is happening now. Wow, what a story. Well, next week we're going to conclude our five-part series. This one's going to be titled Bringing the Buffalo Back, and we'll be visiting with the Siksikaisatapi of Montana. Now, we're going to continue our theme with Washington Post writer Dana Hedgepeth's article, Native Americans Seek Return of Items Looted at Wounded Knee. Now, this appeared in the July 24, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. And we'll give you the main headline first to kind of give you a summary of what we're going to be reading about. Peace offerings of tobacco ties adorned the Wounded Knee Memorial in 2014 on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And this is a photograph that accompanies the article. In 1890, 250 Lakota men, women, and children were slaughtered by the U.S. Army there. Their possessions ended up in sometimes obscure museums around the world. Now on to the story. With the flashlight from her smartphone, Renee Ironhawk peered into the dust-covered glass and wood cabinets inside a small dark museum in Barre, Massachusetts. She and a handful of other Native Americans looked at pairs of beaded moccasins, a dozen ceremonial pipes, and a few cradle boards used by women to carry infants on their backs. The items are among as many as 200 artifacts that are believed to have been stolen from the bodies of the 250 Lakota women, men, children slaughtered by the U.S. Army in 1890 during the Wounded Knee Massacre in South Dakota. They'd ended up in an obscure museum attached to a public library in a rural town 70 miles from Boston. Going through those cabinets, looking at these items of our people with the light from our phones, it was just something deep to me, Ironhawk said. It felt like the breath went out of me. I had to sit down and rest. I had to say a prayer. How a collection from one of history's worst atrocities against American Indians ended up in bar is almost as painful as the memory of the massacre. Some of the items were sold by gravediggers to Frank Root, a traveling shoe salesman from bar who used them as part of his Wild West Roadshow before he donated them in 1892 to the town's museum where they've stayed for more than a century. They are among the more than 780,000 burial items and possessions of Native Americans held in museums or other institutions as of September 2021, according to a report to Congress. It's a stolen collection, Ironhawk said of the bar objects. Just like they stole our lands, it's the same. Now she, her husband, Manny, and their group, Hawk 1890, which stands for Heartbeat at Wounded Knee, and includes American Indians whose relatives were slain in or survived the massacre, have launched an effort to have the items returned to their tribes, the Ogallala, Lakota, and Cheyenne River Sioux. Earlier this year, they seemed to be on the verge of breakthrough, but the deal they struck this spring with the officials from the Bar Museum Association has stalled. Museum officials say they must follow protocols to ensure that the objects are returned properly. The delays have frustrated tribe members. Without those items in their tribal homelands, Manny Ironhawk said, they believe their ancestors are in limbo. For our way of life, when somebody makes their journey to the other side, their spirit has to go and be released, said Manny, an enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Tribe, and a great-great-grandson of a man killed at Wounded Knee. That didn't happen for these ancestors. He said their items and objects need to be brought back so we can do the proper ceremony and their spirits can take that journey to the other side. They need to come home. Native Americans were struggling to survive in the years leading up to Wounded Knee. The huge herds of buffalo on which they depended were gone. They had been forced off their lands and onto reservations. They had suffered devastating losses in battle and betrayals when the United States broke treaties it had signed with them. A census record from 1890 showed Indians were vanishing, according to Jim Adams, a senior historian with the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington. Their suffering fueled a revival of the Ghost Dance, a spiritual movement embraced by some American Indians who believed it would make the white men disappear, resurrect dead Indians, and bring back the buffalo herds. In 1890, the U.S. Army's 7th Cavalry Regiment was sent to stop the rise of the Ghost Dance soldiers. Soldiers tried to arrest Sitting Bull, one of the most renowned Lakota chiefs. Instead, an altercation broke out, and Sitting Bull was shot and killed at the Standing Rock Reservation. Fearing more violence, another chief, Bigfoot, a leader of the Ninja Kankanju Lakota, went to Wounded Knee and set up a camp near a creek, Adams said. On December 29th, the U.S. Army surrounded the group at Wounded Knee Creek. Accounts vary about what happened next. Adams and some other historians say the soldiers demanded that the Indians surrender their weapons. They say most complied, but that one Lakota was reluctant to give up his rifle. Suddenly, a rifle went off and the soldiers started shooting. The Lakotas fought back, but most of them had already given up their weapons. It was a straight-up massacre, Adams said. The soldiers pursued some of the survivors for up to 5 miles in the snow and killed them. Some historians put the number of Native Americans slain closer to 400 rather than the 250 cited by other sources. At least 36 soldiers were killed, and another 20 were later awarded the Medal of Honor for their actions at Wounded Knee. In 1990, Congress issued a formal apology for the massacre and expressed deep regret, but it offered no reparations. That same year, Congress passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, requiring museums and institutions that receive federal funding to return any American Indian remains or objects to their rightful owners. But the law has loopholes, and regaining possession of items can sometimes involve long, expensive legal battles. For decades, Lakotas tried to get some of the stolen items back from the Bar Museum, but got little response. Then, in 2000, Leonard Littlefinger, an Ogallala Lakota and a descendant of Chief Bigfoot, successfully lobbied the museum to return a lock of the chief's hair after providing through a tribal court that he was related to him. Littlefinger said in a 2010 letter to the National Park Service that Annie Miles, the president of the Bar Museum Association Board, had called him in 2007 asking for advice because activist groups were demanding the return of the wounded knee items. He met with her and the museum board, and they discussed donating items to the Journey Museum in Rapid City, South Dakota. But Miles said Journey officials wanted the whole collection, not just the items from the wounded knee, which the board was not willing to grant. We felt that was not the proper thing to do because we had other tribes come and they blessed the museum and they really liked the way the museum presented the items, so we felt that we would be dishonoring the other tribes, Miles said. Still, many in the Wounded Knee Descendants group wanted to pursue getting the items returned. We knew stuff had been stored or sold or traded and in some cases stolen. It all mostly just gradually disappeared, said Wendell Yellow Bull, an enrolled member of the Ogallala Lakota, whose great-grandfather Joseph Horncloud survived Wounded Knee at 16 years old. This year, a Vermont-based activist contacted Ogallala Lakota leaders to help push for the return of the objects. In April, Manny and Renee Ironhawk, along with Chief Henry Redcloud of the Ogallala Lakota Nation, flew more than 1,800 miles to Boston. They had been invited to see the items and meet with officials from the Bar Museum Association. They were accompanied by a few other people from tribes in the Massachusetts area, the Nipmuc and the Wampanoags. When they arrived, the Ironhawk said a representative of the Museum Association Board met with them in the parking lot and told them what seemed like good news. The board had held a brief meeting before they arrived and taken a vote. They decided to return the items. Manny and his wife said they were surprised and a bit skeptical. Still, they tried to stay optimistic. The group met with about six Museum Association board members, most of whom are white. The board members had questions. Where would the items be stored? Would they be damaged? Would they be sold? Renee Ironhawk said she found their inquiries insulting. The board members also set a few stipulations. They wanted to hire an expert to do an inventory and check the authenticity of the items, work that the Ironhawks and others in their group think is unnecessary. The Native Americans were then allowed to view the items. Excuse me. They were told not to take pictures, a museum policy, and not to touch anything because items probably had been treated with arsenic to preserve them. One case held several pairs of suede leggings and a few pairs of children's moccasins. Another contained a few medicine pouches and several breastplates made of shell bones. A headdress with feathers hung in one. Beaded pouches shaped like turtles and salamanders lay in one case. You could tell the leather, the beadwork, and the designs were of Lakotas, said Renee Ironhawk. There was no doubt they were ours. They came from our people. Yet another cabinet held a ghost shirt, worn to protect men at war from harm. After roughly 45 minutes of looking at the objects, the Ironhawks left. They attended a town hall meeting in which about 100 bar residents showed up. Manny Ironhawk shared a story his mother had told him about Wounded Knee. His great-grandmother, Alice Ghost Horse Warbonnet, was 10 during the attack, he said. Men and women took up weapons, and when the shooting started, she was running with her mother holding her hand, he said. They were told, "Run, run, the cavalry is coming to get you. They're coming to hunt you and kill you." Alice survived, but her father, Ghost Horse, and her teenage brother were slain. All of that is carried on in these items from that killing field, Manny explained. It's a trauma, a historical trauma, that we still carry today. After the meeting, Manny said, a few residents approached him and expressed support for the return of the objects. Others said they were surprised to know the town had such items. Once back in South Dakota, the Iron Hawks and their supporters said they expected to hear from the museum board about the logistics of getting the items back, but they didn't. Milas, the museum board's president, said in late June that the association had received a grant to test the items for arsenic. She said the board wanted to ensure an inventory and analysis of the items were done to ensure they were authentic and had come from Wounded Knee. Root, the man who donated the items to the museum, was known for buying artifacts as he traveled and using them in his roadshow, according to Milas. So she said she thinks that some of the items in the museum's collection may not belong to the Lakotas. She said she thinks the items are from 30 tribes across the country. Milas and the board also want the Hawk 1890 members to get formal resolutions passed by their respective tribal councils, so the transfer of the Wounded Knee items has broader support than just a group of individuals who's making this request. Milas said she favors repatriating the items to the tribes because if you meet the people, they are still in a great deal of pain. It's a multi-generational pain, and if we can help them, the Ogallala Sioux people, get closure, I'm all for it. But the Native Americans view the Museum Association's bureaucratic demands as delaying tactics. They said they were going to give them back verbally, Manny said. Now they seem to have changed their mind and gone back on their word about returning them to us. Still, Renee said, the tribe will get the items back, even if doing so takes years. We have a spiritual belief that's strong, and we believe our relatives are going to help us. We will get them home. Well, the Nez Perce are no longer leaving their story to others. Now, they've become tour operators. This article written by Washington Post writer Julia Dewin, and it appeared in the August 6, 2021 online edition of the News and Observer. Stacia Morphine is of medium height, slim, with arched eyebrows and long brown hair separated into two braids, both clasped with panels of red, green, blue, and black beads, dressed in regalia that reflects her Native American heritage. She is leading a Hear the Echoes of Ancestors boat tour on the Snake River between Idaho and Washington State. My name is one who takes care of water, she tells us, as the jet boat pushes away from the dock. Our ability to hunt, fish, and gather across our homelands, whether it's berries, roots, medicines, and the responsibility to hunt our winged and four-legged relatives, is vital. Morphine is talking about the tribe commonly known as the Nez Perce, whose name, meaning pierced nose, was bestowed upon them by French-speaking fur traders. The tribe, which calls itself the Nimyupu, is known for its expertise in horse breeding and fishing. Its most famous member was Chief Joseph, whose 1877 speech marking the tribe's surrender to the U.S. Army ended with, "My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever." Numbering about 6,000 at the beginning of the 19th century, the Nez Perce once roamed 17 million acres across four states. Their reservations is now confined to a patch of high desert less than one-tenth of that size, and their enrolled or official membership is about 3,500. The 765,000-acre reservation is flanked by the Snake and Clearwater Rivers in northern Idaho, with the closest cities being Lewiston on the Idaho side of the Snake and Clarkston on the Washington State side. For years, the tribe has watched as tour operators have built $4 million riverboats business through its ancestral lands. But Morphine is forcing the tourism industry to take the Nez Perce into account and is rewriting her own story, too. This 36-year-old entrepreneur, who once spent 3 years in prison, is now owner of the Nez Perce Tourism, a business that offers dinner tours, powwows, Appaloosa riding experiences, whitewater rafting, of course, the river tours as well. Now, she's hired more than 55 drummers, singers, historians, presenters, storytellers, and artists from her tribe to contribute to the company, the only local tour business owned by a Nez Perce member. The idea behind her river tours is that they will be Nez Perce on board to share insights that other tour companies cannot. Our excursion, which took place when the Clarkston-Lewiston area was experiencing triple-digit temperatures, was also guided by Morphine's Uncle Maurice Wilson, who was wearing a blue Hawaiian shirt. He sat in the bow, pounding a frame drum as Morphine spoke, then lectured about the local herbs used for healing. There have been more than 200 years of interaction between the Nez Perce and white Americans, starting with the famed explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, who traversed the region between 1803 and 1806. This opened up the land to massive immigration by white settlers who eventually dispossessed the Nez Perce of 9/10 of their ancestral territory. As we cruise by the basalt cliffs, Morphine lets slip that she's giving a lecture that night on a nearby cruise ship on the Nez Perce perspective on Lewis and Clark's expedition. We know there's three sides to every story. The first side, the second side, and the truth, she adds. We like to share the truth. Such directness is the new normal with heritage or indigenous cultural tours. Although indigenous tours have been around for years, they've been poorly marketed, says Alexis Bunton, a native Alaskan scholar and author of the book So How Long Have You Been Native? Life as an Alaska Native Tour Guide. Morphine's decision to steer business toward her own tribe is an unusual, Bunton says. It was the same thing in Alaska. There was a cruise industry, but the natives weren't benefiting from it, so they started tribal tours out of Sitka. She sees indigenous tourism going mainstream. I think we're about to see it blow up in the next few years, she said. I know people are really hungry for it. Morphine began her boat tours in spring of 2019 to give the Nez Perce perspective to some 25,000 annual passengers on jet boat tours of the Hell's Canyon area, a wilderness of tall peaks and stunning vistas overlooking North America's deepest river gorge. A lot of companies play off the history of this area, she says, but there was no formal tribal member taking advantage of that. It's also a way to honor the past. Around every river bend, there's a story or village, Morphine says. It's beautiful tying our people to our homeland. As we cruise past landscapes of rangeland and desert grasses, Morphine shares the story of her outfit, starting with the 200-year-old buckskin dress clenched in the middle with a wide black leather belt. Brightly colored beads are on every item of her clothing. Morphine says they originated in Venice and were brought by Russians to the U.S. West Coast, where coastal tribes traded them for bear and buffalo skins provided by inland tribes. Until the late 19th century, the Nez Perce had vast stretches on which to roam and collect those skins. Morphine makes sure her listeners understand the losses the tribe has suffered. This was a Nez Perce village site, she says, as we pass Asotin. That's a small town on the west bank. But not one Nez Perce lives there today. Unfortunately, we were dislocated and moved to reservation boundaries where we didn't want to go, but where the U.S. government wanted us to go, she said. Asotin has once been known as a place of the eels or Eel Creek, she adds. Thanks to the dams on the Snake and Columbia Rivers built by various government agencies starting in the late 19th century, the eels in question, lampreys, disappeared. But a tribal restoration program is bringing them back. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's edition of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. The website again is ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.